And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, has there ever been anything like this Republican primary process? Is one where the party seems trapped into selecting a candidate that most of the people in the party sort of don't want? If there are precedents in history, who would be the person most likely to know them, to remember them, to be able to share them with us? And of course, it would be our own Bill William Lechtenberg, the leading historian of the American presidency, and he's agreed to come chat with us about New Hampshire and history. Bill Lechtenberg, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, D.G. It's good to be back with you again.
You're busy on a number of other projects, including a new book and consulting with the experts in documentary, in the documentary history of America. But have you had time to watch the Republican nominating process?
I feel a little bit the way Obama felt, that he'd start following this when they had voted all but one off the island.
Survivor, you know.
I have lots of faults, but I don't think any of them loom large enough so that I have to submit to watching some of the debates. But of course, I did follow closely the election results yesterday and what they portend for the future.
Well, New Hampshire has played a significant role in American presidential politics, I guess, for 100 years, 80 years? Or when did all this get started, and how far back can we go in reaching for precedent?
Well, its significance in Republican primaries is only about a half century old. It has succeeded in derailing some candidacies and enhancing possibilities for others. But in truth, it has not been a very a good predictor. Of the last three men who were elected president of the United States, all three lost the New Hampshire primary.
Well, I'll share with you my memories. I mean, I've made a pact that understanding that people are listening are more interested in what you have to say than what I have to say. But nevertheless, my memory is shaped from the 1952 Democratic primary, and there was a guy named Estes Kefauver who took his coonskin cap into New Hampshire, if I remember it right,
yes.
and created a stir, maybe momentarily, because here was this Southerner campaigning for the presidency. It looked like he was just about to get a little bit of traction, and then whammo.
Yeah, well, that's right. And Kefauver in 1952 is thought of as the candidate who introduced what's been called retail candidacy, that is going around. If you shake enough hands in a state that doesn't have many voters, the vote yesterday in New Hampshire falls short of 90,000, you're going to win the primary. And
you can win by looking them in the eye, and if they're everything else being equal, somebody's going to vote for somebody that they've met.
Yeah, and somebody who will listen to you, somebody who cares enough to come by to see you.
Well, the other memory is the Gene McCarthy campaign, I guess in 1968,
correct,
in New Hampshire, which he succeeded, I suppose, in helping persuade President Johnson not to run again. But I mean, it was a kind of Pyrrhic victory, sort of.
Yes. What actually happened, and almost nobody remembers anymore, is McCarthy lost to Johnson in New Hampshire. But he ran so strongly, I believe it was 42% of the vote, that he threw enough of a scare into Johnson when accompanied by the polls on the upcoming Wisconsin primary, that Johnson decided to step down. He may have stepped down for other reasons, too, but he certainly knew that he faced a tough fight. One of the odd things, too, about that Gene McCarthy vote is that a quarter of the voters who supported him in New Hampshire took a harder line on the Vietnam War than Johnson did. They were unhappy with Johnson,
not because
he was so militant, but because he wasn't hawkish enough.
That's really, I didn't remember that part of it, but it is true that sometimes these results are deceiving because people are voting against somebody for whatever reason, not necessarily for the platform of the person that they wind up voting for.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, could you translate that into the New Hampshire primary results that we are reading about today? What were the motivating factors for the New Hampshire voters?
Apparently, the single most important one is that the Republicans who troubled to go to the polls wanted a candidate who was most plausible with respect to being able to defeat Obama next November. He was not the first choice of most voters. There wasn't an enormous amount of enthusiasm for him, but he did seem the most electable. The other thing that happened in New Hampshire is that extraordinary percentage, 50% of the votes in the New Hampshire primary were cast by independents. Because New Hampshire law permits this. A few weeks from now, when we hit the Florida primary, that's a closed primary, and independents are not permitted. Only registered Republicans are permitted to do that. So the role of independents was to make possible gains for moderates that are not likely to be of the same proportion in the upcoming primary in South Carolina on January 21st or the one in Florida that succeeds it.
So this is interesting to me, but that are you saying that the independents who are as a majority or close to a majority of the voters in the Republican primary are moderates, and notwithstanding Romney's current protest that he's not a moderate, that he's a solid conservative, that they say he's more moderate and someone I could live with, so I'd like to have him as the Republican nominee. Is that
that's right, DG. They know Romney well because Massachusetts is a bordering state. Beyond that, Romney has a home in New Hampshire. So he's not a newcomer like, say, Santorum, whom they don't know very much about. They find it hard to believe that he is the kind of ogre his opponents are picturing him as being. I think the most interesting thing with respect to what was being said in the campaign is that the main objection from other candidates to Romney has been that he's not conservative enough. That switched over in New Hampshire. It was said that he was an exploiter of workers. Some of them sounded very much like the Occupy Wall Street people.
Was this coming? This was not rising, bubbling up out of the population. This was generated by the other candidates and advertising.
Yes.
And did it get traction? Did it get traction?
Well, clearly not enough because he won the primary, but it's going to be a big part of the South Carolina primary. Millions of dollars in ads have already been bought by Gingrich to drive home this point.
Now it's real interesting. I mean, this. And I'm interested in your thoughts. I mean, none of us can really know what will catch on in the either in the rest of the primary season or the general election. But this term that developed, this vulture capitalism,
yes.
kind of, now maybe it's just because of my own political leanings that has an appeal to me, and that more reasonable, moderate people will reject that as being just unfair characterization of it. The other thing that happened during the primary that it seemed to me to be just an invitation for a political ad was Romney's comment about about firing people. I mean, it was to take it out of context, of course, but
yes.
that's what you do for a political ad, and you just have that smiling guy saying, "I like to fire people." You know,
yeah,
I mean, that,
right.
that. I mean, is that just sort of gonna flow away and as people understand that he was talking about health insurance, not talking about what he did at Bain Capital in terms of getting rid of people.
Right. It was totally wrenched out of context. But all you have to do is do a soundbite for 15 seconds of Romney saying that. I don't think that's going to fade away. I think the Democrats are going to be using it right on to Election Day in November if Romney does get the Republican nomination.
It looks like it didn't get traction in New Hampshire, at least according to the spin that we've gotten, that 37% is an extraordinary, decisive win for Romney. So no traction there?
Well, it's a question of how you look at the figures, DG, because if you put together the Romney vote of 37% with the Huntsman vote, and probably it plays out at exactly 50%, which is to say that 50% of the New Hampshire vote, remembering all along that a lot of this is cast by independents, is for a moderate Republican, whereas the right candidates got the other 50%. Now, all those people voting for candidates on the right, some of them far on the right, may well have bought into the argument about his being someone who destroyed corporations and fired people.
We're visiting with William Lichtenberg. We're talking about the presidential campaign and particularly the results of the recent New Hampshire political Republican primary. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor William Lichtenberg. Two things. He's our neighbor. And he's America's leading expert on presidential history and helping us put the New Hampshire primary and the ongoing Republican primary process in historical context. Before we get into history, we were talking about some of the other candidates. One way to look at it is to say this is Romney's got no victory at all. He had no opposition. I mean, in terms of credible, real credible, possible presidential timber candidates. The second place finisher in New Hampshire, Ron Paul, is, to me, a very interesting mm-hmm. candidate, thoughtful and with a good, solid basis on which his ideology is translated into political positions and seems to be honest and consistent about that, or at least that's my mm-hmm. impression of him. But crazy, you know, in terms of what the results would be, at least from my standpoint, and it looks like from the standpoint of people on the right or the left would not agree with his foreign policy or his radical, non-governmental participation in complete freedom, libertarianism,
mm-hmm.
So that while it's attractive and interesting and stimulating, just, you know, 15 or 20% of us would think we'd want him to be president, but no more. I mean, he couldn't be elected president. So,
well, I agree with what you're saying. And one of the interesting aspects, perhaps the single most important one that we'll be watching for over the next months, is whether Ron Paul, having failed to get the Republican nomination, and I agree that he's highly unlikely to get the nomination, whether he breaks away and forms a third party. Because he believes keenly about foreign policy and numbers of issues on the domestic economy. And he has such zealous supporters that there are all the makings of a third party candidacy there.
Can you reach back in history and compare this sort of libertarian perspective and movement that might translate into a third party effort? Anything like this?
Well, I think the libertarian movement that most comes to mind is that of Barry Goldwater in 1964. But Goldwater, of course, wound up with the Republican nomination that year. I think one can think of times in the past where someone had a strong ideological commitment and insisted on going ahead. The candidate who drew the largest popular percentage over the last three quarter of a century or so was George Wallace. The Ron Paul is not at all like George Wallace, save in that he has a strong ideological commitment and these devoted, sometimes even fanatical, followers. So that, I think that's the example that most readily comes to mind.
I was just, for me, totally different situation, but on the Ralph Nader campaigns from, I guess you'd say from the left, but from a more or less ideologically pure, neither party is really American from that perspective. And we, in order to move things along, we've got to develop this third party. And yeah, we're going to lose, but we're going to get traction for next time. And I don't care if Al Gore loses, or I don't care if Nick Romney loses. It's worth it to get these issues before the American people and get traction. And so if Ron Paul takes this venture or somebody in his stead takes it, what would be some of the likely impact on the election? Would it automatically give the election to Obama?
Well, I wouldn't say automatically, but it would be the biggest blow that the Republicans could receive, because it would divide the anti-Obama vote, and in state after state, that well could be critical. Indeed, I would think that if one knew that there was going to be a third party headed by Ron Paul, you'd probably want to bet the rent money on Obama in November.
Well. What if Paul, for the reasons that we've heard that he wants to protect his son's political legacy and all of these reasons, or for whatever reason, decides that that his movement can best be accomplished by encouraging his people to participate and get involved in the Republican Party and take over the Republican Party if possible, rather than running as a third party? But somebody else says, "Oh no, we gotta confront both Republicans and Democrats. They're both slaves to the Washington system, and we want to take them down." Yeah. Who could lead that kind of effort?
Well, I think what would most likely happen under those circumstances is that you'd get a reduction in Republican turnout, because if he does not become a third-party candidate, and nobody else becomes a third-party candidate breaking away from the Republicans, then arguably, no matter how much they dislike Obama, there are going to be some alienated voters who won't bother to go to the polls.
Well, talking about the other problems that the Republicans have, the in terms of political unity, what we have now facing into South Carolina is something I bet you there's been no precedent for, but I take that back. You've always been able to find the precedent. But we're going into South Carolina, and it looks like one of the candidates, Newt Gingrich, who probably has given up in terms of maybe not given up, maybe he hasn't given up, but the prospects are just very slim for him to be resurrected. But he apparently has taken in a commitment to spend millions of dollars to destroy the presumptive nominee.
Right.
And this, can you think of anything, any time when this kind of throwing a bombshell from inside, it's like, I mean, what it reminds me of is this is the thing that happened in Afghanistan where they invited their spy into the, you know, the best spy that they've got into the headquarters, into the inner sanctum, and he pulls the bomb and blows up everybody. And it looks like Newt's going to try to do that.
Right. The Democrats have to be relishing this because all they need do is run some of the attack ads about what fellow Republicans have said about Romney. That having been said, it's also true that once primaries are over, parties tend to coalesce. I think, for example, in 1980 in New Hampshire, the first George Bush accused Reagan of selling voodoo economics, and yet Bush wound up as the running mate for Reagan in the successful campaign in 1980. I also think of the instance in 1940 when Wendell Willkie attacked Franklin Roosevelt's foreign policy, and then a few weeks later, after he had been defeated by FDR, became a strong supporter of it. And when he was challenged on what he had said, why can you be supporting, given what you said a few weeks ago? He said, oh, well, that was just campaign oratory.
Well, now, it's different, though. What Newt's doing is a little different from that. I mean, that arguably, that was campaign oratory. But what this is bomb throwing. I mean, it's more than oratory. I mean, it's really suicidal. He's destroying himself and trying to destroy the other candidate.
Well,
rather than to win. I mean, it's a vindictive. I'm not after a victory. I'm after to be sure this guy doesn't get it because he hurt me. He hurt my feelings. Sir.
I agree that Willkie was always a much more moderate figure than the people who, as you say, are throwing the bombs. This is a situation where Republicans know that Obama is beatable. He has a serious recession on his hands. Healthcare is not wildly popular. There are difficulties overseas that haven't been resolved. And yet, without meaning to do so, they are behaving in a fashion that is increasingly boosting Obama's chances in November.
We're visiting with William Luchtenberg. We're talking about American politics, especially the presidential campaign in light of the results of the New Hampshire primary. And Professor Luchtenberg and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor William Luchtenberg. We're talking about the American presidency in the context of current events, including specifically getting his take on the meaning of the results of the New Hampshire primary and what newscasters have characterized as Romney's decisive victory.
Yes, it's a case where perception is everything, because Romney won in the Iowa caucuses by only 8 votes, and it was expected all along that he was going to win New Hampshire, where He has a home, as I was saying earlier. So from that point of view, it's really not all that remarkable. If those 8 votes had been cast in a different fashion, it would be being said at this point that all of that Romney has managed to do is take a neighboring state, which everybody thought neighboring to when he was governor of Massachusetts, that he was expected to do all along. So the race is wide open. Mm. But the fact that he's won 2 in a row, he is the first Republican who is not in the White House ever to have done that. It gives him a sense of being an inevitable victor.
It seems to me, help me with this, that the inevitability is primarily because there's no other credible option out there.
I think that's the most important feature of it. He goes into South Carolina, which has a tough right-wing electorate in Republican primaries. He could go down to defeat in South Carolina if all of the conservatives were to unite on a single candidate to oppose him. But there's no indication at all that's going to happen. Indeed, we can say it's not going to happen.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because the most presidential of the other candidates is, in my judgment, John Huntsman, and he's not likely. He's to the left of Romney, if anything. He's more moderate, and so that's probably not going to catch on in South Carolina. Maybe I'll be wrong about that. And Newt has destroyed himself. Santorum lost all of the momentum that he had from Iowa in the New Hampshire primary. Maybe, though, he could get traction in South Carolina, but you don't really think of him as being presidential timber quite yet. I don't know.
I agree.
I've always been a fan of Governor Perry as being the kind of person who would be attractive to a wide range of conservatives. But apparently, one little gaffe, one little memory lapse, and I forgive memory lapses, but the American public the Republican primary voter and supporters have not been able to forgive that. So what's the option?
Well, I thought that when Rick Perry announced that he was going to be a formidable mm-hmm. candidate, a candidate one could well imagine defeating Obama, having a great deal of strength in the South and being able to carry that huge Texas electoral vote into the Electoral College and toward the end of this year, but he's just floundered in New Hampshire, and of course he didn't enter New Hampshire, but he only got 1% of the vote, which is pitiful. I think he'll do better in South Carolina.
I think there's slim chance he could get some traction in South Carolina if the stars were in line, but that's a remote a possibility, even though remote.
Yeah, he may get. I would think he will get a fairly he's obviously going to do better than 1%. But if he registers even 12-14%. That's going to keep him in the race into Florida. You were saying earlier, DG, that the media have been talking about the emphatic victory in New Hampshire of Romney. Normally, when somebody gets 37% of the vote, a little more than a third of the vote, it's not regarded as an emphatic victory, and it's only because of this divided field.
Yeah.
So that's what favors Romney in South Carolina. He does have a lead in the polls there, and he has the support of the very popular governor, Governor Haley, in South Carolina. And with the field still splintered, he doesn't have to get a very large percentage of that South Carolina vote in order to prevail there, too.
We're visiting with William Lechtenberg. We're talking about presidential politics. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with William Lechtenberg, our neighbor here in Chapel Hill, and known worldwide as the, we think, and many people would argue, as the premier historian of the whole American presidency. And now, Bill, before we get started, are you writing another book?
Yeah, I'm writing History of the 20th Century Presidency. It's commissioned by the Annenberg Foundation. It's going to be published by Oxford University Press. It's under contract to them. And it starts with McKinley's assassination and carries through to the election of 2000.
And when will we see it? Christmas of 2013.
Probably the year after next. It's a formidable assignment.
It really is. It is formidable for anyone, but for you, you've written lots of stuff from Roosevelt on onward. So you got all that covered. You've also written a biography of Herbert Hoover. So you've gone backwards in that extent. You couldn't do Roosevelt without knowing everything about Woodrow Wilson and that administration, so you got that covered. Yeah. What was it that you needed to do to prepare yourself to write this book?
Well, most of it is that's new is on the more recent presidents.
But you've done In the Shadow of FDR, which covered a lot of that.
Well, it does help to have had that background of having written other books.
You're not like all these professors. They say that they don't write new books. They just reshuffle the old ones.
And I always thought you were my friend.
but it is helpful to have that whole, I mean, an encyclopedic basis of notes and some things that you'd wish you'd been able to use in earlier books that you can, you know, bring them to life.
It's true. And as you were saying, I had to deal with much of this in earlier books. Many people think the main American history textbook is The Growth of the American Republic in two volumes, which is Samuel Eliot Morison, Henry Steele Commager, and myself. So I had to deal particularly in the final revisions of that book, which I started in the came aboard in the 60s, with all of the presidents. I edited Wilson's The New Freedom and Theodore Roosevelt's The New Nationalism. And then I wrote a book which is probably the book that sold the most. I'm sure it is, The Perils of Prosperity, which covers 1914 to 1932.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And I'll do most of this later, but the introductory chapter to that about 1914 is one which I hope you'll be finished with your other book so that you can revise that chapter in light of the 100th anniversary rather than the 50th anniversary of that event. I mean, that's
the longer one lives, the long more anniversaries there are.
No, but that anyway, we'll do a program on that chapter. But now let's get back to 2012. I'm so sorry off track, because one of the things that puzzles me, okay, let's say, I think it's too early to say that Romney's got the nomination, but let's say that he does. Mm-hmm. And he's got all this experience with a primary and lots of, with the primary process and the competition for the nomination. Oftentimes, although not always, a president looks to his competitors in the competition to see which one of them got some traction and which one of them might, even not in spite of the competitive arena of the primary, and might have been some harsh words said. They say, well, I could really get along with this person. I'd like that person to be on the ticket. If Romney's nominated, have any of these candidates made a potentially successful run for a vice presidential nomination?
Oh, I think it's possible, but I would suppose that he would reach out to somebody for example, a woman governor.
Maybe you'd ask this woman, Sarah Palin, who was the former governor of Alaska.
Certainly nobody predicted that. And with respect to your saying that it's too early to predict who the winner is, we need to remind ourselves that just a few weeks ago, the polls showed that the front runner was Herman Cain.
Well, what about Herman Cain as the vice presidential candidate? Rick Santorum or Pawlenty, all of these people who've come in, or Michelle Bachmann.
I don't think he's going to move in that direction. But I think he would be well advised to put a woman on the ticket, but not a Palin or Bachmann.
Who are the available Republican women on the conservative side? Who is the 2012 Sarah Palin? Where would you go to find her?
I would think he probably would not want to go all the way over to a conservative. He would take a moderate Republican woman would be more likely. The problem is this, D.G. The one generalization you can make that always holds up is that in Democratic primaries, the voters are going to be farther to the left than is the electorate. And that in Republican primaries, the voters are going to be farther to the right. And Romney's problem has been to get enough of those right-wing voters to regard him as a credible candidate. Once he wins the nomination, if he does win the nomination, which does seem likely, then he faces an entirely different electorate, not entirely different, but considerably different electorate, and has to show that he's moderate enough not to scare independents, not to scare others who are disaffected from Obama, but still not certain that there's a better choice out there.
Well, some of the people who are not Romney fans would say, well, he's in a better position to flip-flop than any other candidate because he's shown that he can change his mind in response to the electorate in which he's operating. I think that's an unfair criticism because I think that's what politicians do all the time.
But
I wanted to ask you in that connection, as we expect Romney to take more pragmatic positions, as assuming he's the nominee in the election, I've got this memory of your illustrating how politicians sometimes change their rhetoric, and this has to do with Franklin Roosevelt's 1932 election campaign, in which he was – is that right? Do I remember this right? He was arguing to balance the budget.
He said he denounced Hoover for running the biggest spending administration on peacetime, piling bureau on bureau, commission on commission, words that were to seem comical just a few days after he took office, when he greatly expanded the national government.
So we forgive – I guess what I'm suggesting is that we forgive politicians for changing – we may grouse and grumble and throw flip-flopping, but we really want them to adjust and be pragmatic rather than ideological in their approach to the problems as they see them.
Well, with FDR, you're talking about the kind of campaign he ran and the kind of presidency he later carried out. I think the vulnerabilities of Romney will be the flip-flopping, to a degree, perhaps, his Mormonism. The general view has been that would hurt him more in Republican primaries than in a national election, because in Republican primaries there are a disproportionate number of true believing Protestants. The election is very likely going to turn on the economy. And if the economy continues to improve and the unemployment figures have dropped from 9% to 8%, that's going to make Obama's chances look better than they did 6 months ago. Defang some of Romney's claim that he's the person who can bring about recovery. The the attacks his fellow Republicans have been making on him as somebody who has destroyed jobs is something the Democrats will pick up on in the debates on the economy.
Well, just a moment. You studied John Kennedy, and we experienced a reformation in American politics by electing a Catholic president. And haven't we put is the Mormon issue going to be really? I mean, it'll be there, but is it going to be decisive or all?
Oh, I don't think so. No, no. And of course,
I meant to say that in New Hampshire, almost a majority of people in New Hampshire voted for a Mormon candidate, one or the other, Huntsman or Romney.
Now, of course, once again, let's remember, in a very small electorate, something in the high 80,000s, it's going to be one of those underground sorts of issues. On balance, historians, political analysts believe that Kennedy's Catholicism hurt him more then helped him in 1960. It's been figured out to be about a 2.5% spread. More Catholics came to the polls because of this, but offset by anti-Catholicism. And Kennedy prevailed not because he was a Catholic, but just despite his Catholicism.
Well, listen, lots more to talk about. Maybe I'll just have to twist your arm and get you to come back and continue this conversation. It's been great, as always, to visit with Professor William Luckenberg. Thank you.
I'll be glad to come back, DG.
Great. And thanks to you for listening. It's been DG Martin with Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.